supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Host the Canadiens at 7. Union looking for their first win of the season are in Chicago at 8:30. And the Phils in preseason play meet the Red Sox at 1:35. You're listening to WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we answer a frequently asked question that we've been dodging for the past decade. How do you grow sweet and crunchy carrots? We're also going to talk to a guest who will talk about the terrifying syndrome of white nose in little brown bats that threatens to devastate this species of bats that does so much to control insect pests in our gardens and farms. Well, that's a lot to get done. We better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Molly, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you?
I'm doing good, Mal. How are you?
I'm doing well. Just wondering about what herbs you can grow together and then what kind of lettuces you can grow in a heat box in your backyard.
Now, where are you?
In Oklahoma City.
And what do you mean by a heat box?
Well, my grandpa's been gardening for a really long time, and that's really the only place I've ever, or like who I've ever gardened with. And he grows his lettuces in this, like, heat box that he built, and it's got kind of a white, I don't even know what the material is, but it's just a white top that he can open and close through the day, so it's almost like a little sweat box for his lettuces, and they just grow in there.
But that's for the winter time.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I mean, he uses it in the summer, but I guess he must just keep it open all the time.
Yeah.
Or close it in, you know, the evening so the animals don't get into it.
Well, in Oklahoma, your summers are going to be hot, and they're going to be windy. Now, are you growing outdoors? Are we growing in containers? What are we doing here?
I mean, I'm interested in both.
So you do have outdoor growing space?
Very limited, mostly in pots. I have a little bit of garden space, but we're talking just a few feet.
Okay. Well, what I would suggest you be doing right now, for instance, is growing those salad greens in those pots outside. Lettuce and spinach and peas and pansies have to be grown in cool weather. They're not going to survive your summers. Summer would be time to grow bell peppers and tomatoes and zucchini and squash. You can buy started plants already at a garden center right now and put those in your containers outside. Go to our website. Go to You Bet Your Garden. Go to Garden Answers A to Z, a big link at the top, and then go to C for container gardening, and it'll tell you what those containers should be filled with and how to take care of them. You have time right now to grow at least 3, 4, maybe 5 runs of salad greens, cut and come again style, where you harvest them with scissors and they'll regrow. And then depending on the size of the containers and what you like to eat, when we get to the real warm part of summer, say, you know, June in your area, the lettuce will be shot. You can take that out. The pansies will die off. And then you can replant it with some summertime crops. Although if your space is small and your containers aren't large, I would urge you to grow just about anything except tomatoes. If you do have a little area outside, even if it's small, you can put a couple tomato plants in the ground there. And you had asked about herbs. Your winters are probably too cold for rosemary to survive over the winter time, but any annual herb will do fine. Because you're in Oklahoma, it would be good to find a spot for your containers that gets morning sun and afternoon shade, because your summers can be pretty relentless, and I don't need to tell you that that the plants need to be protected from your howling, hellacious wind.
Yeah, that's pretty creepy.
But typically what you do is you plant in Oklahoma in a protected area. A lot of times people think they lose their crops to the summer heat, but it's actually the wind just driving the moisture out of the plants. So you can play around with things like an old beach umbrella that you can set up on really hot afternoons to provide some afternoon shade. And then it can be something as simple as some lattice work that you set up around in the area around the containers to block the wind if you don't have an area that has a windbreak protecting it. You're going to do great. Outdoors, not indoors. Containers, herbs. I want you to get some lettuce in the ground right now because that's going to fool you into thinking you're good at this. You're gonna have great results with the lettuce for a couple of months. And you can do the same thing in reverse in the fall. Once the temperatures start cooling down, you can get more lettuce in and grow until really freezing temperatures arrive. So you can use those containers for a good part of the year.
Cool. Okay. Perfect.
Have a lot of fun this spring and summer. You're going to have a good time no matter what.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking my call.
I appreciate your making it.
All right. Well, have a good one.
You too.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Justin, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. How's it going?
I am doing well. Justin, how are you, sir?
I'm good.
And where is Justin good?
I am good in Dagsboro, Delaware.
I never heard of that town. Which part of the small wonder is that located in?
It's southeast Delaware. It's about 10 miles west of Bethany Beach.
Oh, okay. I know Bethany Beach. That's a beautiful little seaside resort there.
Yeah, it's pretty nice over there.
What can we do for Justin just a bit inland from Bethany Beach?
We've got Bermuda grass that continues to come up in our flower bed. And as much as we pull at it or cut at it, it just keeps coming back.
And what is the wanted plant contingent of this bed?
We've got daylilies and then some knockout roses. There's some daisies and a flowering almond.
Oh, a flowering almond. That's going to be a problem. How close is the invasive grass to the almond, or is it all around it?
Yeah, it kind of gets everywhere.
Now, whether this is Bermuda grass or crabgrass or any of the warm season grasses that have been invading further north of their range. I mean, we've always had crabgrass. Crabgrass has a unique way of survival over the winter. Luckily, the identification really doesn't mean anything because we know that you have a warm season grass that has very aggressive spreading underground rhizomes, right?
Right.
That's really the distinction, though. Exactly what kind of grass slash weed you have doesn't matter. What does matter is that we understand that as the season progresses, as it gets warmer and warmer, this grass gets stronger and stronger. Does it turn tan and dormant over the winter at least?
Yeah, typically.
Okay, and it hasn't started greening up yet?
No, not yet.
Okay, well, it's your game to lose now, but it's going to be a lot of work. I'm going to warn you of that right away.
It always is.
Do you use any kind of mulch at all?
Yeah, we've been using like a wood mulch. We've tried using some compost as well. Some of it was compost that we've made, and some of it was compost that we bought. And you can usually tell the difference in that the compost that we've made, we tend to get squash and tomatoes and some cilantro growing out of it as well. And the stuff that we've bought sort of introduced some other more interesting-looking weeds as well, so I don't know that it was the best compost that we put down, but we do have like a sort of a wood mulch typically that we put down there.
And you can see now that the wood mulch has been tremendously ineffective.
Yeah, well, it does keep coming right back up through it, yep.
All right, well, we're going to have to figure out a good organic mulch for you. You're going to have to seek out something like a cocoa shell mulch or a seed and hull mulch, because I want you to get off the wood mulch.
Okay.
And you do have to have really professionally made compost to make sure it doesn't have any weed seeds in it. I want you to take the rose and move it. Take it up out of the ground. Roses move very easily. You can either heel it in, which is just a temporary planting, while you do this, or if you think you really want to take your time and be really aggressive about this, replant the rose somewhere else for this season, and you can move it again next spring. Same thing with the daisies, dig up the roots, and as you're digging up this entire bed, which you're going to have to do, you'll find the daylilies, and you'll put them somewhere else. If we can get everything out of there that you want, your climate is going to be very good for solarizing. I want you to get all this stuff out. I want you to cut out as much existing grass as you can. Then I want you to level the surface of the soil, level it perfectly, soak it with water beyond soakability, and cover it with clear plastic. Put bricks on the edges to hold the plastic down and let it bake all summer long. You okay. will sterilize every seed. You will destroy every bit of rhizome. And the craziest part, you can replant all this stuff in the fall, by the way. Fall is a great time for planting. The soil life, for some reason, that returns to this spot that's been sanitized is better than the soil life you started out with. So it's an investment of clearing that bed for the season, but you'll get a better garden bed out of it. And then if the grass is coming in from the sides, you got to drive in edging. Otherwise, you have to be relentless with a high-quality mulch to make sure it doesn't come back. But if it's not coming in from the sides and you solarize correctly, you're out of this.
Okay.
All right, Justin?
All right, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Good luck, man.
All right, thanks.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and get another run of my pre-sprouted pea seeds in the ground and transplant more of the lettuce I've had growing under lights indoors, outdoors. Although planting time is still almost 2 months away for warm season favorites like peppers and tomatoes in my garden, it's prime time for cool weather lovers like peas, lettuce, spinach, and pansies that must have cool weather to produce well. But don't you go starting your springtime garden just yet, because we'll be right back with how to grow sweet and crunchy carrots, what you can do to help save the bats, and more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden, made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee is a gardening resource featuring vegetables, flowers, videos, and more. The 2012 catalog is now available online at burpee.com.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Medford Lees, a Quaker-related community for those age 55 plus and home of the Barton Arboretum, proudly supports WHYY. On April 14th at 11 a.m., it's their annual Arboretum Lecture featuring horticulturalist and author David Culp. He will share how native plants harmonize with our natural environment and help create sustainable landscapes. Light lunch and arboretum tours follow the lecture. Information about this event and details about Medford Lees' communities at medfordlees.org.
The forecast, we've got some rain heading toward our area and even in some parts of the area at this hour. Temperature 62 degrees.
Seventh Generation supports WHYY, makers of plant-based 4X laundry detergent, a cold water clean in a cardboard bottle. Energy and money-saving laundry tips are available at 7thGeneration.com. 7th Generation, caring today for seven generations of tomorrows.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it's a question we get frequently. How do you grow carrots that are sweet and crunchy? We'll give you all the details later on. We'll also answer lots more of your fascinating phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guest, Dr. Hazel Barton, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Akron in Ohio. She'll be giving a lecture called The Sky is Falling, White Nose Syndrome in Bats at the Wagner Free Institute of Science in Philadelphia on Saturday, March 31st. And she has been seen in an acclaimed IMAX movie, Journey into Amazing Caves. So she spends a lot of time with these endangered and important creatures. Dr. Barton, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thanks for the invitation.
Well, thank you for being here. For those of our listeners who might be curious as to why we're talking to someone about bats on the show, the answer from a gardener's perspective is that if there were no bats on this planet, my understanding is we would be overwhelmed with pest insects.
We would, actually. Somebody has calculated the economic impact of that and the impact it could have in America. And if you include industrial agriculture, you're looking at up to $57 billion of impact. And that impact is reflected in people having to use more pesticides, paying more money, and also the loss of plants as a result of that.
Right, because one thing I think people misunderstand, there's a lot of misinformation. People grew up being told that bats eat mosquitoes, and that's why it's good to see them flying around at night. And I've been led by other bat experts to believe that bats eat very few mosquitoes, but they do eat a tremendous number of larger night-flying insects, which the more you know about entomology almost puts an equal sign between that and garden pest.
It's really interesting to think about the impact of bats. I think that's something people don't think about. They often do think about mosquitoes, and obviously there's a human impact there with potential transmission of diseases such as West Nile virus. But a bat biologist told me one time that mosquitoes are like popcorn for bats. So we might eat popcorn, but we don't go out of our way to eat it. It's just if it's there, we might grab a handful. And bats are like that with mosquitoes. If they're flying around and they grab one, they'll just kind of pop it in their mouth, but there's not a lot of nutritional value. But a moth, I mean, a nice, big, fat, juicy moth for a bat, that's a fairly good meal. And a single bat, a single female bat who has got young, she can eat up to 2,700 moths in a night.
2,700?
100, yes. She can eat, especially when she's getting ready to go into hibernation, she can eat her own body weight.
I want to go to the dollar store and get one of those little fake tin cups that says world's number one mom and give it to that bat. I mean, that's an enormous number of garden and agricultural pests that never get to be born.
Right. Yeah, when you think about, you know, how many eggs does a single moth lay, I think they can lay several hundred in one go. So that's a lot of caterpillars.
And, of course, there are enormous diversity of bats around the world. I guess where you are in Ohio is pretty much the same kind of bat population that we have here in Pennsylvania and the rest of the East Coast, and that's a big percentage of our bats are the little brown bat, right?
Correct. I believe within the East Coast area, and that's primarily looking at the Appalachian Mountain region, that seems to be a good boundary for them. There, I believe they estimate there's about 9 million little brown bats. But that number has pretty much been decimated. We're anticipating that species will go extinct in our region by 2020.
No, I mean, that's tomorrow.
Yeah, and people already are seeing impacts of that. I mean, people, they do tend to notice the mosquitoes more because obviously if something bites you on your arm, you're going to notice that. But you know, I have friends who live in areas of West Virginia and Kentucky that have been impacted, and they're like, you know, I've noticed there's a lot more mosquitoes than there were last year.
And I realize this is the basis of your research. This is the basis of your talk. I think everyone has become aware that there is a fungus that's affecting hibernating bats. Give us the short take on what this does to the bats and what we know about it.
Well, it's a devastating disease. It really affects the bats when they're in hibernation. It's called white nose syndrome because a bat that has it looks like its nose is being dumped in powdered sugar. And so it has this white nose. And the impact of this organism would be very similar to having athlete's foot. So if you can imagine you're trying to sleep, but your entire face is covered with athlete's foot, it's going to disturb you. And a bat that would normally stay in torpor for, you know, 14 days, we're seeing them wake up every other day or every 2 days. So it doesn't take long for them to eventually starve to death.
Now, these bats are native species, right? They've been here for thousands of years, and they've been observed carefully by humans for hundreds of years. Where did this thing come from? Why? What happened?
We think that this is an old world disease. So this would be akin to smallpox coming to the Americas with Columbus and crew. So as a new world species, so a species of the Americas, they haven't adapted to and they're not resistant to these new pathogens that get introduced.
But are you implying that there are European bats that have evolved to have a natural immunity to this disorder?
It's been seen in a number of countries, primarily in France. I believe it's also been found in Germany and Romania. And there is a syndrome that looks very much like white nose syndrome in bats in France. They wake up, they wipe it off their face, and they carry on as if nothing's happened. They do behave slightly differently than North American bats. North American bats will hibernate in very large clusters. It's amazing to go into a hibernaculum, an area where bats hibernate, and you can see 5,000 individuals in a patch that you could stretch your arms across. So they cluster very tightly together. And the problem with that is if somebody comes in who's sick, everybody in that group will get sick too. Whereas in Europe, they tend to hibernate on their own, maybe one or two bats. So if one guy gets sick, he's only going to make his neighbor sick. He's not going to infect everybody around him. So that might be one of the issues we're seeing. The other is we do actually see species that are more resistant to it in North America, and they like to hibernate in slightly different conditions. It looks like the fungus likes it to be nice and moist and humid, and some bats don't like that. They like to hibernate in drier conditions. And those bats don't seem to be as affected. And so that's another potential mechanism the bats in Europe have used. So they've developed almost an avoidance mechanism. Their behavior has changed to make them less susceptible to the fungus.
Is it possible that they used to behave like our bats? And as you said, they've developed this avoidance behavior, you know, because you paint a bleak picture. Hearing that it came from the old world, I had all these hopes that we could, you know, isolate a cure and, you know, treat some of our bats and have them pass on the immunity. But do you think that over time, the best hope is that different survivors will develop different ways of hibernating, that it'll just be this small subculture of loners, loner bats that carry on the DNA of this remarkable creature?
I think that's what we're really realistically looking at. We've tried very hard. This was first seen in 2006, and we've tried everything. It's been so aggressive in the response, especially from the federal agencies and the state. Pennsylvania Game Commission has just been fantastic in the way they've dealt with this. So it's been very aggressive, but I think it's Mother Nature, and she's got the best solution, and that is looking for these communities that have natural resistance and change their behavior.
Now, let's bring this back to the garden. I didn't really expect you to talk about the clustering of the bats, the massive density being part of the problem with the little brown bat. But is this something now that gardeners might be able to have a positive influence on? A lot of gardeners are tremendously interested in bat houses, learning the correct type of construction, erecting them near the garden. Could people who put up the correct type of bat houses, I understand you need to know what you're doing, but any bat house is going to have many fewer bats than a giant cave full. Could this be a way to accelerate the development of a resistant population?
I think that would be a fantastic solution. Building a bat house is a real trick, and Bat Conservation International has a little leaflet you can download from the internet on how to build them, and the tricks you can have, like take some guano and rub it on the inside so the bats are more likely to populate it. But I think that's a fantastic solution. But what people can do in the winter is if they see unusual bat behavior, they see bats flying around maybe when it's cold and there's snow on the ground, or a bat maybe flapping around on the ground that really is behaving the way that bats shouldn't behave, and they alert the state authorities, either the Division of Wildlife or the Game Commission. If they do that, they can have a profound impact because it can help us track the progression of where this pathogen, this fungus is moving, and help us take steps. So we can alert people. We can try to block human behaviors that might promote the spread of the organism. We don't yet know if humans are involved, but certainly with other diseases like foot and mouth disease, if you see that in Europe, it's very easily spread by human activity. So what we can do is we can go in and try to mitigate some of the problems best we can. Anything you can do to create a habitat for a bat is a fantastic thing to do for bats in general.
So, gardeners, build bat houses, build them correctly, find out the details. They need to be big. There needs to be clearance at the bottom so the bats can drop in and out. Don't use pesticides and report strange bat behavior to the authorities, because every bat we save is a legion of insects we won't have to battle in the summertime garden. Dr. Hazel Barton, Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Akron in Ohio. She'll be giving her lecture on the white nose syndrome in little brown bats on Saturday, March 31st at the Wagner Free Institute of Science in Philadelphia. Dr. Barton, keep up the good work and let's all hope for a miracle with the little brown bat.
Thank you. I think we all are hoping for that.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing well today, Steve. How are you, sir?
Hi, I'm doing great. I'm calling from the Graduate Hospital area in Philadelphia.
Oh, I know that. They don't call it Graduate Hospital anymore.
They probably don't, but I'm calling from around South Street.
Okay.
So I have this roof deck which faces south. I'm a little concerned about, should I be elevating any of the stuff off the deck? Should I be worried about the heat that might be generating off the roof deck at all?
You're definitely going to have sun-stressed plants up there. Now, is this actual wooden decking that is elevated from the roof of the house?
Yes, so it is a deck that's elevated. My best estimate, trying to hang over and measure, it's about maybe a foot off of the blacktop roof.
Okay, but it is blacktop, and there's no way you could be clever and put something, white would reflect heat, black is going to absorb it and put it back into the plants at night. The good news is because of your black roof, you could be growing now lettuce pretty soon. Well, I mean, if you pre-sprout them, you could be growing peas now. You could be growing pansies up there. All the cool weather crops are going to do really well for you in the preseason and the postseason because you're in the heat sink of the city and because that black roof is going to absorb and hold heat and feed it back to the plants at night. The black roof is not going to be your friend over the summertime, but neither would a white roof, which again would reflect the heat back onto your plants. You don't plan on going away over the summer, do you, Steve?
Not for an extended period of time.
Okay, because you're going to have a lot of watering duty because of your southern exposure, and you have easy access to the roof, apparently.
Yes, I have a private door to this deck. So.
And are you going to have to haul water?
Yes.
Mm. You want probably, as you plan your garden, to plan some sort of rainwater harvesting system. I'd have to go over the weight of a full rain barrel. That might be too much for you, but maybe something that would hold like 20, 30 gallons of water that you could store from rainwater or something screened that you
okay.
could tap into, because you're going to get tired of hauling water.
Okay.
The bigger the containers you use, the better. Make sure you fill them with a combination of what's called soil-free mix and compost. Since you're starting with a clean slate, you have an advantage in this. How many stories off the ground is the deck, though?
Like on the third floor.
Yeah, so you're going to have to haul all this stuff. Make sure you get plastic containers. You know, terracotta is going to wick its moisture into the air. There's going to be much more issues with keeping your plants well watered. And the glazed porcelain is just too heavy. We want to keep the weight down, and we're going to do everything we can to retain water. So when you fill these, I do want you to go to our website, You Bet Your Garden, and go to Garden Answers A to Z and read the container gardening under C. But because of your situation, I want you to go heavy on the compost in your containers because it's going to retain water more. And I want you to find a good organic mulch to put on the surface of your containers to keep the water in there. And then if summer is just unrelenting, you're going to have to figure out, well, you would probably even like some sort of a retractable shade cloth for you to be up there in the summer sometime, right?
Yeah.
So at least for this coming season, try to think of something easy and temporary you can rig up. Professional greenhouses all have shade cloth that they roll over top of the greenhouse in the summer. So you might be able to rig up something just by building some supports on the edges of your deck. It may not look the best right away, although maybe you're handier. You have a friend who is. With you, the issue is going to be making sure the plants are adequately watered and giving them some afternoon shade. But otherwise, I mean, I really want you to think a lot about spring and fall because you are going to have the best cool weather garden imaginable up there.
Oh, sweet.
All right, Steve?
All right, thank you so much.
Good luck, sir.
All right, thanks. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind listeners who plan on growing their first garden this year to think small. Just start with a few raised beds whose soil you've improved with lots of compost. If you try and plant too big a patch, you'll quickly lose control. And don't be afraid to buy plants like peppers, tomatoes, and cucumbers that were professionally grown instead of trying to start your own from seed. Learn how to kill big plants outdoors before you move up to killing tiny little ones inside your house. But don't go rescuing those skinny sprouts on your windowsill just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to grow sweet and crunchy carrots in your own backyard. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. For over 135 years, Burpee has provided gardeners with seeds and plants for everything from tomatoes to flowers to gourmet herbs. Online at burpee.com.
We've got 61 degrees in Center City. This is WHYY.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. Next Saturday, March 31st at 1 p.m., the Wagner Free Institute of Science on Montgomery Avenue in Philadelphia will present a lecture by our guest on today's show, the University of Akron's Dr. Hazel Barton, on the ongoing crisis of white nose syndrome in bats, again, one of nature's best pest controllers. Also next Saturday, Rutgers Earth Center in New Brunswick will present a free workshop on backyard composting from 10 a.m. to noon. And the Delaware Master Gardeners will host workshops on growing tomatoes on Thursday, April 5th, composting on Saturday, April 7th, and growing vegetables in containers on Thursday, April 12th, all at the University of Delaware's Newark campus. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
Later today on Fresh Air Weekend, science writer Johan Lehr tells us how taking a nap or a shower can lead to a creative burst. He's explored the creative processes of artists like Yo-Yo Ma and Bob Dylan. And also TV critic David Bianculli previews the return of AMC's Mad Men. Fresh Air Weekend comes your way at 1 today here on WHYY. Brief look at the forecast, showers, and a high of only about 62.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll reveal the secrets to growing sweet and crunchy carrots. You won't want to miss it, and you won't. Just sit through a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Lou, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Good talking to you.
Good talking to you, Lou. Where are you, sir?
I'm located in South Jersey, Atco, New Jersey, actually.
Atco Speedway, Sunday.
Everyone says that, yeah, right.
Oh, we grew up with those commercials. What can we do for Lou from South Jersey?
Well, here's my issue. I have a small yard, front and back lawn, and in the backyard, I've had a problem which is progressing over the past few years of moss in the grass. It wasn't that bad initially, but I've noticed over the past 2 or 3 years it's gotten much worse, and it's overtaking. It's about three quarters of the backyard now. Actually, the grass has been taken over by moss, and I really don't know what to do about it. I'm concerned because obviously at some point it's going to completely take over the grass in the yard. Not a problem in the front though, which is kind of interesting.
Well, because the front is sunny and the back is heavily shaded.
Correct, exactly. That was my next comment. The back is much more shaded than the front. So I don't know what I can do.
You didn't have to tell me that, Lou. I've been doing this for 25 years. I knew your backyard is shady.
Right.
Now, the good news or the bad news?
Give me the bad news. Go ahead.
The bad news is that the moss is always going to be coming back and coming back and coming back because that is the natural ground cover. Under
right.
trees and in heavy shade. There is no grass that will thrive without at least 4 hours of sun a day. When you factor in the additional stress on a lawn of competing with tree roots for nutrients and moisture, the poor grass really does not have a lot of things going in its favor. The good news is that moss makes an exceptional ground cover if you cultivate it. Now, you do have some negatives. You'll never have to cut it. You'll never have to feed it. And it'll stay green all year. Other than that, it's perfect, Lou.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I guess those are my options. And given what you said, it doesn't look like, other than cutting down trees and opening up the backyard, which I really don't want to do because I do enjoy the shade, I'm going to have a situation that's going to be perpetual. So
right, you have a nice looking lawn out front. That's
right.
that can supply all your lawny needs. Out and back, what normally nature grows under trees in a damp, shady, acidic environment is moss. Now the additional good news is if you don't like the moss you have, you can replace it with a different moss. I'm not just being hippy-dippy and saying let nature rule here. There is a big trend to use moss as a no-care lawn substitute. So there are many providers now who will sell you specific types of moss in sheets like sod that you can lay down or in dried form that you mix with water, add a little buttermilk or beer, and then spread around your lawn. So you can get a different textured moss. You can get a moss that has different tints of color, especially reds in it. And you can also get mosses that can tolerate a fair amount of foot traffic. If you let the lawn be naturally replaced by nature's ground cover, it is probably going to look a lot better from your back window, and you can even utilize the backyard.
Okay, well, I guess the good side, the positive, is I won't have to worry about cutting the backyard. It's just the front, which cuts my work time in half.
And you will have a better looking, quote, lawn out back eventually than you will out front.
Right. Okay, well, great.
Okay, Lou, so actually, you know, you should go to our website, go to You Bet Your Garden, go to Garden Answers A to Z, and read the article we have on moss lawns. And it'll help you if you do choose to go this way to accelerate the moss taking over the grass. And I think once you see what you're going to get long term, you're going to slap yourself and go, why did I fight this for so many years?
I hear you. Okay, great. Well, thanks for the advice. I appreciate it.
All right. Good luck, Lou.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Paula, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Paula. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I am doing excellent today. Thank you. Where is Paula Fine?
I'm in Audubon, Pennsylvania.
Where all the birds must be beautifully drawn, right?
That's right.
All right. What can we do for Paula from Audubon?
Well, when I was growing up, we had a gardener named Catherine Henney, and she had a prize-winning garden, the best vegetables, the most beautiful flowers in the flower show, and, you know, she'd take them in and win prizes. And so she was the expert as far as we knew. She did two things to enhance her garden, and I'm wondering whether they're a good idea for me or whether her garden did great in spite of it. One thing she did was she'd go out into our woods and she'd push away the leaves, and she would take about an inch of wood topsoil and work that into her garden. And the other thing she did was she would find rotted tree stumps, and she would dig out all the rotted and bring it back in bags and work it into her soil like you would peat moss. Are they good ideas?
Well, you had me up until you said peat moss, because I love your old gardener's style, but you would never work peat moss into your soil.
That shows you how little I know about peat moss. But what do you think about rotted wood dug into the soil?
Well, I think what your old gardener was doing was, instead of making her own compost, she was harvesting finished compost from the wild. It's funny you actually used, during your description of what she was doing, the phrase topsoil, which, if you're going to a garden center and buying a quantity of dirt-like substance in bulk or in bags, the word has no legal meaning whatsoever. But if you dig down deep into the horticultural terminology, you'll find that, quote, topsoil, if it means anything, means the top 30 centimeters of an area in a forested part of the world that has not been disturbed. Because it is the result of years and years of leaves dropping down and eventually turning back into very rich soil, small twigs that eventually turn back into the soil, the blasted remains of any green plants, a little bit of rabbit manure and deer manure. And in the forest, this material is called duff, and that's generally the top 30 centimeters of an area, and it is superbly rich and perfectly balanced. It is the material that has fed our forests and our woods and our wild areas for untold millennia. And with the rotting logs, what she has done is taken wood that will never survive as wood once the tree is dead. It will slowly rot. Fungi in the environment will colonize it and accelerate the process of decomposition. And at the far end of that cycle, and especially in those rotted areas in the parts of the logs that she would wisely dig out, that's finished compost.
Mm-hmm.
That's, again, the same material that would nurture the forest. The only downside is this would be a bad thing for a multitude of people to do, because you would eventually take the nutrients from the forest that the forest needs to survive. But one lady doing this on a limited scale, I have to tip my gardening cap, because she is essentially not making compost, but harvesting compost from the wild crafting of compost. And I have even brought material like this back from the woods. One year I found a big piece of wood. It was almost too big for me to move, but I was able to move it because it had the most magnificent carpet of moss on it. And I took it and I just dropped it into one of my flower beds, and it existed there for like 2 or 3 years until it finished its decomposition. And the year after that, I grew the best flowers in that bed that I had ever had. So this is what we imitate when we collect our own fall leaves and shred them up, and instead of taking them out to the curb, we make compost from them. That's exactly what she was doing, except she was letting nature and time do the work and then harvesting the finished results. And I'm not surprised that it was an award-winning garden at the end, because I give an award to the woods every year for how beautiful they look.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Paula. It's great to hear these stories of these old wise people who really knew how to get the right material. And, of course, we have to say, because she was doing this, she wasn't using chemical fertilizer, an early innovator of compost, and somebody who got the compost without the work of making it. So I admire her on many levels.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for sharing your story. That was a lot of fun.
Okay, bye.
Take care. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Get loose and light to grow sweet carrots. You Bet Your Garden producer Alexis Landis, we get a lot of questions of this type about growing carrots. We picked two to answer this week. Read them off.
Maureen from Harleysville, Pennsylvania writes, I love carrots, but mine never develop that sweet, crisp taste. I've tried growing different varieties and harvesting early and late, but always the same result. Blah, dull, boring carrots with very little flavor. I've had similar results with beets, but beans, tomatoes, and peppers all do well. Why can't I grow good carrots? And we also heard from Zeb near Nashville, Tennessee, who writes, last year I grew some nice-looking carrots, but they lacked color and taste. What can I do better next year? So, how can you help them?
Well, when above-ground plants do well and root crops do poorly, it's generally due to heavily compacted soil. Imagine trying to push your little self through dense clay. Poor taste in carrots can also be due to an overabundance of nutrients, especially the most common of the big three plant foods, timing, the weather during the growing season, and of course, variety choice. Let's start, as all good gardeners should, with the soil. You can't expect to sow carrot seed in rock-hard clay, especially clay that you've been further compacting with your big feet, and get anything other than some green growth on top and a small, unhappy, and misshapen rear end underground. Carrots require the absolute loosest soil of pretty much anything we grow. That's a raised bed where the soil is never walked on, with excellent drainage at the very least. Even better would be a raised bed into which you have mixed a good amount of something to lighten and loosen the soil, like perlite, a mined volcanic mineral that's popped into little balls that look like styrofoam, or a soil-free mix designed for seed starting. Better than that would be a nice deep container with excellent drainage filled with, ideally, one-third soil-free mix, one-third perlite, and one-third light-screened compost. This is not a place for any kind of, quote, topsoil or garden soil, even if your garden soil is naturally sandy. But if that is the case, try growing some carrots in a raised bed of that sandy soil plus some compost. Nutrients. Carrots are the opposite of heavy feeders. Too much of any nutrient, even supplied in organic form, can make them taste woody and look hairy. This is especially true of nitrogen, which makes for the worst tasting carrots, so don't use any kind of manure or chemical fertilizer. 2 inches of high-quality compost worked into the soil, or even better, into that soil-free mix, should be all the food they need. If you have to add something, carrots do like a little phosphorus and potassium, the P and K members of the NPK scale, but go light. Now, carrot seed germinates best in warm soil. The roots grow best in warm but not hot weather, and the taste is always the best when those roots are harvested after a cold night. That makes late summer the ideal time to start the seeds. On average, it takes carrots about 70 days to mature. So if I, in my kind of Zone 6, kind of Zone 7 Pennsylvania garden, planted some seeds on July 1st, they would sprout right away in the warm soil, the green tops would love the sun, and then the night should be getting cool by harvest time. A July 15th sowing would be better, and August 1st would be ideal, pretty much ensuring that I could harvest after the kind of cold night light frost that really concentrates those sugars. If you must plant in the spring, I strongly suggest you do so in a container that's big enough for the roots to go down nice and deep, but manageable enough for you to move it outdoors easily. Sow the seeds while the container is inside, then move it outside after the carrots have sprouted. No matter what or when, keep the seed packet handy and harvest a test carrot exactly when the plants reach the days to maturity indicated. If the root is light in color, wait to harvest the rest. They're still immature. If the color is right but the taste isn't there, you waited too long. For the sweetest flavor, always harvest first thing in the morning, preferably after a cool night. Again, no matter what or when, soak the growing medium really well, sow the seeds thickly, cover with the tiniest amount of soil-free mix, and then either mist the surface morning and night for outdoor plantings that are exposed to direct sun, or cover with clear plastic, indoor sowing in a container for moving outdoors after germination. If wrap you choose, remove it when the first sprouts appear. Keep misting every morning until the sprouts all have some nice green leaves. Then thin them until the remaining plants are several inches apart in all directions. The more room between them, the better carrots you'll get. And begin watering normally at that point. Mulch with compost or some shredded leaves to prevent weeds. And finally, variety choice. Most sources consider the blunt-tipped Nantes types to be sweeter and more reliable for home growers than the long and slender ones commonly found in supermarkets. The somewhat short and stubby Danvers and Chantenay types are also good bets for backyard growers. Well, that sure was some good information about growing sweet and crunchy carrots, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition, just click the link in our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to cultivate my carrots in concrete if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired report, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and perhaps check Foist to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Our webmasters are Batty Rich Banowitz and Sarah the Girl Wonder Kazar. The very sweet Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our crunchy production assistant is Amanda No Relation McGrath. Deeply rooted Al Banks is our editor. I'm blunter than a Nantes Mike McGrath, and I'll dig down deep to see you again next week. The colorful spice saffron cost a fortune, but it grows on a flower. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the unusual fall-blooming crocus that produces saffron, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Honeysuckle, honey bees, herbs, hawthorn, Mike's hale and hearty hands-on advice will hasten the harvest of your happening garden. Join us Saturday mornings at 11 for